a scientific one, and despite all of the dissension at the time in the 17th century, Galileo really is already and pretty much immediately considered a kind of founder of that of something that's properly scientific, to the extent that we still say Galilean science in some context. So I guess I'm asking firstly a question about the decision to look at those Descartes simulations rather than the Galilean observations, and secondly to talk about even the difference between observation and simulation is itself at that time they're probably anachronistic terms. So I guess I'm just asking for clarification, firstly the choice of the Descartes, and secondly a clarification of even what counts as observation and simulation under those very different historical conditions.
Well, I have
Okay, so shortly, I have to say that this paper is written in a cooperation with an astrophysicist, and the images which we chosen, there are several criteria to make the selection. First of all, the models, no, why Descartes and contemporary astrophysicists, no. And it's a lot of things to do about it. But what I've presented on this importance in the visualization, and not only visualization, but conceptualization of matter in Cartesian physics, it was very innovative at that time, no? And this is why, and also after that, no? And this is the reason, because not only because of the relevance of the matter in the model, which is not so crucial in the in other models, no, but also in the model itself, no, when analyzing the structure and evolution and all the concepts behind the vortices, there are many a lot of potential from a modern or contemporary point of view. And on the other hand, the second part of the images, the contemporary ones, are chosen, they are strictly scientific materials as used by the scientists now, no? Or by the cosmologists now. No? And for example, this last image with the pies, red and blue, it was, I don't remember the name, I'm very bad with the names, but it was shown, for example, in a when the person became the Nobel Prize, no, of physics. No? So this is the image he used as to explain or to make this lecture when the Nobel Prize was received. No? And the other ones as also working images, so to say. No? So my criteria or our criteria was to choose only images from a scientific context like the scientists are using it. No? And this comparison between observation and simulation, this is one, not every astrophysicist are making it, but the cosmologist working with dark matter structure and these kind of things I talked to, this is exactly the process, the method, no, of working. They are, for me, I love it because I come from the art, no, and for me it's like, it's crazy, you know, this process to make science, but it's so, no, they are running computer simulations, of course not arbitrary, but with no concrete parameters and so, and they run the program several months, and after that they say, okay, I have this simulated galaxy formation, and we have to compare this with actual data, no, in order to see, okay, it was grown, it was, no, how accurate is it, no. So I'm not sure if I answer your question, but
I think it's a great start to an answer. We might pick up some of that later on. Thanks very much, Lucia.
Directed towards Lucia, but I mean, anyone can answer it, I guess. It's a broad kind of question about something that you were showing, and it does follow on a little bit from Justin's point of clarification in between sessions. I ask it because I was struck by something that was shown in both Harry's paper and in Doug's paper, and that was in Doug's paper the little footage of the microorganism, and in Harry's paper the photograms or shadowgrams of the ants or termites. Now, in both cases, there's a a background. And in the case of particularly of the Harry's shadowgrams, the background is a bleached out, overexposed surface. Now, the thing that was interesting and that I'm curious about is the... Am I doing that? That cone went right through me, the tip of that cone. The thing that was curious was the in the diagram, for instance, the Cartesian diagram of the planetary system and so on, where particles and force lines and so on are designated by marking. What is the background in that? A white surface. Is it the absence of information, or is it the overexposure of information? Is it a gesture towards the absolute? And if it is the absolute, is the background the absolute of distance or the absolute of proximity?
Okay.
Thanks for such a metaphysical question. I think Lucy is going to attempt to answer, and then other members of the panel.
Yeah, no, I briefly mentioned in the presentation, in the card, there are some critical points, but one of them is this differentiation between void and vacuum, and he was convinced there is no vacuum in the universe. No, and for him was every part of the universe is composed by particles, and he established almost infinite subdivision of particles into more into smaller ones and in a crescent or decrescent process. No, and so now for him is this background is only. It's like in contemporary examples also, when they are presented the voids, there are only less dense, how do you say it? Sparse density of particles. But in Descartes, it was clear that a vacuum, maybe because of metaphysical reasons, it wasn't possible at all.
There are different levels of answer to that. First of all, there's figure ground. I mean, it's the ground. I mean, just from a visual point of view, and that's the initial visual conception. But those invertebrate works are seen as intermediary. And the intermediary to being re-exposed under starlight, in which that ground becomes the space between, and the space between is analogous to the interstellar space. And so there was a kind of morphological analogy that I was interested in. So both are happening. It's both an aesthetic decision, purely based on having a figure ground arrangement, and secondly, to reference the apparent, and I'll emphasize apparent emptiness between the visible objects that will be next to those invertebrate pieces, which is the stars. So there's that analogy. So it's actually purely a formal decision based on the visual qualities. I might add that the arrangement of the invertebrates was highly managed. I mean, there's a video online which you can look at, it's a 40-minute video that includes night footage using night vision equipment of some of my 20 or so, I didn't mention the 20 or so assistants that helped me. On the many, many nights we had to days and nights we captured creatures, and I haven't shown you, but capturing poison spiders and scorpions is particularly challenging, and keeping them alive and not hurting them. But the thing is that it's about a choreography, really, in the end. A choreography intended as an analogy to the stars.
So So you have ant wranglers. For Ashcraft, it's not a void; it's a plenitude. The little critters in his rain barrels on his property are as much a part of it. They populate. There's a diversity populating. He's sharing the space with them as much as he shares the these radio waves and meteors. And he has an every night he records these fireballs and with an all sky camera. He's just observing everything all around him. So there's no void there. I mean also within kind of within a Timothy Morton frame, I don't think there would be a foreground and a background. You know, it would be sort of like, what's the environment there? I mean, you can talk about sort of representational modes, but he actually has a notion, that very art-friendly notion of a hyper object at the end of ecological thought, that is the hyper objects for him are things like styrofoam and plutonium, these sort of objects that humans have released upon the Earth that are on a totally different temporal frame than them, that they're going to last beyond their survivability of the species. So he says that to understand the environment, we should make hyperobjects sacred. At one point, he says, you know, we should get plutonium and encase it in gold and make it, you know, this is, these are sort of, you know, images of infinity and things larger than us. But it's also the idea of a hyperobject is also a distributed, the thing, the other hyperobject is not distributed on a temporal realm. It's distributed spatially in terms of pollution and,
One more
question. Yes? Doug, I enjoyed your decision to present an independent artist with considerable... I enjoyed your decision to present an independent artist, and I'm in awe of the transdiscipline character of Thomas's practice. I'm wondering if you'd care to comment on that decision in relationship to the title of your position at COFA. You were introduced as Professor of Media and Innovation. I may have touched on sensitive institutional politics, but I'd be keen to know if there's some inspiration from Thomas in that title.
I don't know. I arrived, and I found that was my title.
We've been in contact
sort of
with
nomenclature.
We'd already been in contact.
But the two are connected. The book I'm writing now has to do with sort of trying to put nature, capital N, kind of what we used to know as nature, back into media. Communications, which is the one place where nature doesn't exist in terms of ideas of communications technologies. It's sort of last best hope for modernism and sort of a teleological ineluctable march of civilization through technology. There is sort of an ecological thing within the media and innovation, I didn't name myself that, or my parents didn't name me media and innovation.
Okay, so Paul. Thanks very much to our panelists, and we're going to move straight into.